What's up, guys? Cameron here.
This is Matt.
Hey, it's Aaron again.
What's been happening?
I'm just coming off of a Dune 2 IMAX viewing. We'll have to save that for another date.
I feel like that's coming up soon. It's not going to happen immediately because I'm going to be traveling for a bit. But when I return from my travels, let's schedule something because it is timely and everyone's talking about it.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, on today's episode, we are returning to the Thunderdome. We haven't done this in a while, guys. It's kind of nice to be back.
Definitely.
Today, we'll be revisiting the Showdown Arena. This time, the contestants are the movies that we think are perfect. Of course, perfection is in the eye of the beholder, and we are thankfully the beholders. We each picked three movies before the show started. As always, we rank the movies based on their aggregated score between Rotten Tomatoes and IMDb, and then narrowed it down to the top eight. Of the top eight, they are ranked as such. Starting with number eight, Uncut Gems. Number seven, In the Bedroom. Number six, Jurassic Park. Number five, The Fugitive. Number four, No Country for Old Men. Number three, Unforgiven. Number two, The Dark Knight. And number one, last but not least, The Godfather. Maybe at the end of the episode, we can reveal who nominated which movies. It's been months since we did this, audience listeners, but maybe we can remember which movies we nominated up the top eight. I will hope that you guys can, because I can't really remember what I nominated. Okay, so before we jump into the show, I just wanted to ask you guys what your thought process was when you nominated your three movies. Because I had one, but I feel like it's probably different amongst the three of us.
Yeah, so I mean, a little bit like our last episode with Movie Roulette, I was going for winning. As you can see from the poll, I'm winning in terms of having selected the best movies. So I went for that with Perfect Film as well. I mean, these are the films I think that are perfect, but I think everyone else is going to feel the same way. So that's part of
it. Wait, how many votes have been cast?
Enough to indicate that
more than one, less than five.
And
all of our listeners have voted.
Is there an answer there?
All of our listeners have voted. All four of them have selected me.
So it was four votes cast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thus far, I haven't checked today. But yesterday,
it was four.
At last count, let me check on X and see what we're tracking
also
here.
Also known as Twitter.
We're at four votes. I see 0% for Cameron, 0% for Matt, and 100% for Aaron, and that's me.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it's just it's indicative, you know.
What were your selections again?
For Movie Roulette?
Yeah, do you happen to remember?
Oh, goodness. There's so many selections.
Did you have
Dumb and Dumber? No, I had Dumb and Dumber.
Oh, no, you had Dumb and Dumber. Okay.
True Lies.
Yeah.
What else do we have? Oh, Interview with the Vampire.
Yes.
I feel like there's another one in there somewhere, right? What were the other categories?
There were five. So, Dumb and Dumber you did for comedy, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
Interview you probably did for horror thriller.
Yep. True Lies was blockbuster.
Blockbuster. And then drama.
Oh, Legends of the Fall.
Legends of the Fall.
That's right.
And Wild Card.
Don't remember the Wild Card. Whatever it was wild.
Who did Matt pick Ace Ventura?
Matt picked Ace Ventura, yes.
Okay, that's right. Okay.
Which I think is actually a better pick. It's a more risky and appropriate pick for comedy. Here's a question for you, and it's a genuine question. I have an answer that works for me, but it maybe doesn't work for everyone. Are there films for you that only work for you because you watch them when you watch them and you were the age you were when you watched them? Because like there are a whole slate of films like that for me.
Not that I can think of.
Oh, man.
There are definitely movies that I saw when I was younger that I have a different feeling towards. But very, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I think this is what you're asking me. Did I see a movie back in the day that I thought was great, and then now I think is not as good?
That's not what I'm saying. So okay. What I'm saying is, let me give you the perfect example for me. The movie okay. Rounders mm-hmm. is 100% a top film for me, like whatever, top 100 film. I love it. It hits on every note for that genre film.
Yeah.
If I had not watched that, as a whatever I was, 18-year-old playing Texas Hold'em in my dorm room as I was watching it, that film would not have resonated nearly as much. And I would have, it would have just slipped through the cracks for me. It wouldn't have had the significance. But because it was like immediately a mirror to my life experience,
right?
It was super powerful.
I feel like that's a little hard for me to answer. Because I truly, like, it's hard for me.
Oh, so there. I mean,
sorry.
For me, I think there are a lot of
Can't hear you at all.
There are a lot of comedies like that for me. Particularly like 90s comedies that we talked about last time. Dumb and Dumber, I think, is a case in point for me. Like that movie will always be funny to me. If I watched that for the first time when I was 35, you know, several years ago, I would have blinked. I mean, or I would have turned my head, you know, just kind of moved on.
Yeah, I think I'd piggyback off what Matt was saying, that like the comedy is very easy for me to say because certain comedies just like don't work nowadays. And when I see a comedy that's reminiscent of an old style of humor that comes out today, it doesn't work. And I can like feel that it's not working, but I know that it's almost identical to the same style as past comedies, and those worked in the time. But outside of comedy, I don't know. I'm sure they're out there. I can't really think of any off the top of my head though.
That's
maybe some kids movies. Like,
interesting.
Like we talked about,
I was going to say Mighty Ducks actually.
Like,
I was going to say Mighty Ducks.
But like it came out when I was a kid and it was awesome. Or like Air Bud. Like that's a bad movie. But it has a dog.
I don't think you were alive when Mighty Ducks came out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm saying I was a kid when I was watching it. I think the first one came out like right when I was born.
Or even another movie that's like that for me. I watched The Beach with Leo DiCaprio at a moment when I was living my life kind of like DiCaprio in that film, whatever his name was. And for me, I could identify with that character. And so the movie seemed amazing, even though I'm confident that was a mediocre film. And that is part of like, there's a window, and I think it's adolescence to early adulthood where there's an identifying with either the story or the character that amplified a film's significance for me that has largely gone away. Today, I mean, I'm not saying I'm perfectly objective. I'm still impacted by my own experience, but my blindness to the quality of the film versus my appreciation for whatever the character's struggle is has diminished, you know, increasingly as I've aged.
Interesting. Do you think it's maybe not diminished, but just changed?
No, because I think I can watch films that are about characters that I can't identify with, but I can see that the film is magnificent, and I can do that without a real leap. And I can watch films where I identify with the character, but the film is mediocre and it's mediocre to me. Like the identifying with the character doesn't elevate the film with me.
But do you, I guess what I'm point taken, but in a different way to look at it, and this is more what I was getting at. Do you think you're still drawn to certain subjects, but those subjects might just be different? So
maybe for sure,
character based, but like anything to do with any of your ideals or politics or particular interests?
Absolutely. I mean, when you get the stars aligning on, you know, interests and, you know, I don't know, identity, all the things that you want from a film, whatever it is, like if it, if it is resonant for your experience and it's a fantastic film and it's timely, holy cow, that's like the holy trinity of, you know, great film. But, you know, and I guess probably that will come through in some of these movies we talk about on the Thunderdome today, because I think some of what makes a perfect film a perfect film, in my experience, is when it hits me and how it hits me. So like, where am I in life? I think for me, a perfect film is a film that is perfect and also has special resonance for me. Like maybe that's what makes it perfect for me. There are films out there that are probably by design perfect, but they're not going to reach the top of my list because they're not, I don't know. They just don't have the same kind of impact on me, or I don't sit there, you know, up at night thinking about them or whatever it is. So the ones that I threw in the list today or for today are films like that. They continue to be part of my collective thinking on film.
Yeah. I like that. Mine is very similar to that. So what's your thought process, Mac?
Yeah. So, I had proposed this idea and kind of with the thought that we would all have our own definition, kind of like, I think, was it Congress who said about pornography, you know, when you see it. So what does perfection mean? There aren't a lot of films I feel this way about, like, wow, that was a perfect film. So my criterion basically was, many months or even years after I've seen a movie, does it come back into my head and I think, wow, that was a perfect film. Now I can go backwards and reverse engineer and pick apart why that might be. But that's what I went with, and movies that came to top of mind were ones I chose. It's possible one got up there because I saw it in the last year and a half. But the other two I saw a long time ago. So they definitely have stood the test of time in my own subjective mind.
Interesting. Okay. So am I gathering that longevity is the main thrust of what you're getting at, right?
Longevity is more like a stress test over time. For me, it's like, does this thing, like if this were a sculpture in a museum, would people look at it and say, wow, I can't really think of what I would change about that. Like, it's maybe not what I would have made, but that is in its best form. That is a beautiful thing, and it's in the best form it can be. And that's impressive and something that will stick in my mind.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's interesting because mine is basically the mold of, or the joining of both of your,
the perfect synthesis,
points of view on this. For the purposes of this episode, I wanted to focus on movies that I connected to personally, even though that they're objectively movies that I think are perfect. But how I define a perfect film is like what you said, Matt, not to sound like a douche, but like I'm an aspiring filmmaker, and I often like will break down a movie as I'm watching it and sort of study it and see how they did things, maybe think of ways I might have done something differently. And if I come out of the movie and I think I would not touch anything about that, in my eyes, it's perfect. So yeah, it's kind of...
We didn't plan for your perfect to be the child of our perfect. Yeah.
I really liked your analogy of walking through, you know, a museum and seeing sculptures. And I mean, I think for me, it's probably partly this like, is this perfect? But it's also like, did it make me stop and keep looking? And then when I walked away, did I keep thinking about it? And did I want to like revisit it? And is it something that like, whether it's revisiting it in my mind or actually walking back, like that, because I think there's a lot that's perfect, but to be my perfect, it needs to be like, whoa, like I need to reconnect with that. I need to see that again. And art really does that for me. So that was a great way of capturing that.
I think in the cases we look at, in this battle royale, there's at least one I have in mind, Aaron, that does highlight for me that at least an emotional connection is important. I mean, we talked about Nolan earlier. I think Christopher Nolan has at least one other film I can think of that is perhaps, in my view, more perfect than Dark Knight, but for me is not as perfect because it doesn't evoke any sort of emotion from me. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, on that note, let's get into it. I guess I'll do what I normally do, which is run through what the matchups were prior to our pre-show voting. Our first matchup was between No Country for Old Men and The Fugitive. Those were the 4 and 5 seed. And The Fugitive won 2-1. Our second matchup was the number 6 seed, Jurassic Park, versus the number 3 seed, Unforgiven. And Unforgiven won 2-1. Our third matchup is the number 7 seed, In the Bedroom, versus the number 2 seed, The Dark Knight. And The Dark Knight won unanimously. And then our final matchup was Uncut Gems at number 8 and the number 1 seed, The Godfather, with a huge upset, March Madness style. Uncut Gems won 2-1. So real not Cinderella unanimous, story. But still an upset. All right, should we... We'll get into it, but let me just say our matchups are Uncut Gems versus The Fugitive and Unforgiven versus The Dark Knight. I guess let's just start with Uncut Gems versus The Fugitive, since that's the last one I was talking about with the crazy upset. And I'll just say I'm pretty sure I was the one that voted for The Godfather. And I think you two, I don't know
that's
if we're
my
supposed
guess.
To be revealing this, but the reason I'm bringing it up is because I was floored by the fact that this won, even though I love this movie. I was stunned, and I'm sure we're going to have some good podcasting because of it.
Look, for all my Sicilian friends out there, apologies. We've done you wrong. Don't find us in the dark of night and lay a horse's head in our beds. But I am confident that I have reached a point in my life where I need more than your classic mafia story to have the emotional resonance to call a film perfect. And The Godfather's great. It you can deconstruct it, and it just like it's perfect on all these lines. And I didn't live it. I am a child of a person who found The Godfather to be perfect. And it's a perfect film, but it's not perfect for me. My lived experience doesn't capture the era in which The Godfather was made. And so there's a distance for me from that film. And Uncut Gems is absolutely the opposite of that. It is very much an experience film, and a film that captures so much of, again, it's that kind of adolescent pre-adult period of my life that is like encapsulated in this fireball of chaos. And I've never experienced a film like Uncut Gems. I walked out of the cinema after seeing that with my father-in-law and brother-in-law. And I like looked at each of them and wanted to make sure that neither of them was going to say anything negative, because I didn't want to have to chew them out. I didn't want to like have to like be like, fuck it, I'm done. This is the end. Like,
I'm done. I'm divorcing your sister and daughter.
I like, it was that powerful a film. And I was shocked that, you know, my father-in-law loved it, but it was an absolutely
kind of surprised by that.
Absolutely magnificent film. I've never been through a more, like I had a minor heart attack in that film, but that was the purpose of the film. It was supposed to induce minor heart attacks.
I think I was experiencing chest pains myself. I had chest pains, and the only other film that was as anxiety inducing for me was There Will Be Blood. Like, those two movies made me anxious more than any other movie, but Uncut Gems much more so. I think this is one of the best films ever made. When I saw Uncut Gems on, I'm assuming it was Aaron's Perfect Film nominations, I was jealous right away and wanted to take The Godfather off and put it on. So that's why it was an easy vote for me. I can't say Uncut Gems reflects my lived experience. There are a lot of things in that movie that I've not experienced, but even that vibe. But just, the film had me on the edge of my seat. There are not many films I will watch again. That is a film I will watch again.
I would be curious actually to know what, you know how they do those like random polls as you, or surveys as you leave the polls, both in the political sense, but also in the theatrical sense. I would be curious to know, like, if they had a doctor on standby and just like did a heart rate test of everyone, or a blood pressure test. I'm have to assume that the vast majority of audiences had raised both of those.
Yeah, I am for sure. And I don't think I've ever talked to fellow film lovers and gotten a more one-sided gender response than Uncut Gems. I have never met a film that pissed off more women than Uncut Gems. I knew many women who told me they walked out of the film. And I kind of racked my brain a little bit about like what it would have been that would have been triggering or offensive. And certainly there's a lot of like objectification that happens, but not at a level that would have seemed to warrant that. I don't know what it is. I'm reaching out to the audience. Please tell me what it is. I know that it was clearly catering to a male audience, but why did it offend so many women? More than a handful of women that I have spoken to said the film was one of the most offensive films they've ever seen.
That tracks with my experience also. I mean, I have actually not talked to I'm sure there are plenty of women who really love this film. I've not talked to one who said they love this film. I remember after I saw this film, I talked to a barista, and I just in passing mentioned Uncut Gems, and she said, "I hate that movie. That's one of the worst movies. We'll talk about that next time you're in." And then a global pandemic erupted, and I never talked to that person again because of COVID-19.
Interesting. I will say that is not my experience. I don't know if it's a generational thing or if it is a just so happens to be the women I'm talking to happen to like it thing.
I got to compliment the film as well on just so seamlessly blending fiction with reality. I mean, that doesn't give it any special bump, but it was a novelty that I'd never seen before. There are lots of films that incorporate real events and even real footage into the film. Nothing has come even remotely close to what Uncut Gems has done. I mean, it was like something out of Quantum Leap. I mean, you were like, oh, I mean, for sure, Adam Sandler was at a Celtics game. Like, I mean, it just like felt like this was all really happening.
Like a docudrama almost.
Yeah. I mean, it felt like they were tracking this person's life and it was real. And that amplified the significance in some way. You know, it just felt extra real because there was that element.
But I think that this is partly due not only to the use of real life events in the movie, but also how they cast the movie. The fact that I can't remember, it was years ago when the movie came out, but I feel like I remember hearing that they used a lot of real life people as some of the roles. So like, a lot of the jewelers were real jewelers, and you can tell, like, you can just feel it when you're watching the movie that like these guys are jewelers and they know what they're doing and they do this every day and they're not even acting. This is just how they interact with people on a daily basis. And I think with the real life events, it was like a docudrama.
Yeah. And I'm sad that the Safdie brothers are, I mean, it, one of them, Josh or Benny, which one's the one that's Benny. In Oppenheimer?
So Benny is the actor. Josh yeah. is like the behind the scene or behind the camera director.
Yeah. I want them to do more. I feel like this is like the Coen brothers, like split up too much, too quickly. It just like, it's disappointing.
They broke up faster than
they need
the Beatles.
To. They,
yeah.
They
it's really
movies, three right? movies. Okay. Let's discuss the other film in the matchup, The Fugitive.
Just very, very briefly. The other thing is, not only did the casting bring in all these real people, but Adam Sandler. I mean, totally out of left field. Like, who would have expected he could give a command performance like that? Like, everyone knew that he had comedic ability and could certainly carry some lines, but that kind of a powerful, like, deep gut punch role, I think that also was partly responsible for Uncut Gems perfection. Because and especially for people who grew up watching Adam Sandler in a particular vibe, suddenly having this person as a middle-aged gambling addict, it was just
perfection.
Anyway, sorry. I'm effusive for the film.
I mean, he's done it a few times. I wouldn't say it's the first time he's had like an amazing dramatic role, but it's done so rarely that when it happens, and combined with the fact that the movie is good, is amazing.
Well, what's the role before that? Sorry.
He was good in Spanglish.
I mean,
Punch Drunk Love
is really good.
Amazing. Yeah. Spanglish is a good one. Funny People's a
Punch
good
Drunk
one.
Live, Punch Drunk Love funny. Is amazing. That is amazing. I'll give you that. I stand corrected.
Okay. Let's talk about the other movie in the showdown, which is The Fugitive. I don't think it needs much introduction, but I'll just say it's an amazing movie. Harrison Ford, Tommy Lee Jones, could not be more different than Uncut Gems.
It is the best TV movie ever to make it to the big screen, far and away. And that is a compliment, not a detraction. I think it is a movie that if you look at it today, you're like, wait a minute. This is like a extremely high quality, like 1990s TV film. And the special effects are not particularly special. They're cool, but they're again, like, I mean, they're not impressive even for the date when the movie comes out. And the movie relies heavily on dialogue, but it's fantastic dialogue. It's just, it's amazing. But it's just anything but a blockbuster caliber production. And yet it's a blockbuster film. And there are so many amazing scenes that I don't know if they are, but they feel like the dialogue's improvised, or they feel like the dialogue is like coming right from the gut. And there's so many scenes where they're highly quotable. Like, the action that happens is not particularly impressive, but the dialogue is so impressive and it's so quotable, whether it's like Tommy Lee Jones' sidekick, whatever his name is, Cosmo.
I think it's Cosmo.
There's like, you know, the guy with the ponytail. And of course, I mean, three quarters of the quotable lines are Tommy Lee Jones, like wisecracking. But even, you know, like Harrison Ford's like kind of sincere, deep moments are like, you're like, whoa, okay, this is like really solid, serious scene from an actor who is wisecracking and as Han Solo or whatever. Really great film. And thinking about the old TV series and having seen a few of those episodes, which, I mean, it's okay, but it's like really, really TV series serial from way back in the day. Yeah. This was an impressive remake. And that sometimes I think gets forgotten too, because I'm so far removed from it. But I mean, it's a remake of a TV show.
So growing up, we always used to visit my grandparents' house outside of Cleveland in Avon Lake, Ohio. And I don't know if this is true or not, but when we go past Lake Erie, my mom would always point to a house and she'd say, that's the guy who said the one-armed man killed his wife, this doctor that they based The Fugitive on. And so I just remember that house. We'd always pass that house. I actually, after this really? Episode, I'm going to look up to see if that's really where he was. But I think he was from outside of Cleveland. And I think the real guy probably killed his wife. I shouldn't say that. I don't want to be sued for libel. I don't remember. But obviously it was a difference. You know, he wasn't a fugitive for the course of a whole serial production, but.
We're going to receive a cease and desist letter.
He may be innocent. Episode. I'm sorry. He's probably one of our fans because we have so many fans.
If we did discuss The Fugitive on a past episode, I do not remember this fun fact arising. So I appreciate it regardless.
I don't think we discussed it previously.
Kind of an amazing story.
So I'm just going to put that out there. I did a real quick dive into Sam Shepard, the person on whom The Fugitive is probably based. And just because of what happened, I do want to clarify for the record, we don't know what happened when his wife was murdered, because he was initially convicted of second-degree murder, but then he retained F. Lee Bailey, who secured his freedom. And F. Lee Bailey went on to represent Patty Hearst and O.J. So even though F. Lee Bailey has passed since, I do not want the O.J. Simpson's lawyers team looking askance at our podcast. Don't need that in my life.
I mean, even Johnny Cochran's gone, man. You don't have anything to worry about. Just own it. If you think
like
the dude's
Cato,
guilty,
I feel
I'm
like Cato Kalin would come after a fellow Wisconsinite. I know he wasn't the lawyer.
Wait, sorry. Can we just back up really quick? Is this doctor named Sam Shepard, as in the famous Sam Shepard,
the actor,
writer, and actor?
I know.
No,
I totally
Sam
thought
Shepard,
you were going
I mean,
a different
you,
direction
is,
with
the,
Sam
the murder
Shepard.
Was in 19, yeah, was the like, early 1950s. He became a pro wrestler later.
He was a doctor and became
Shepherd,
a pro wrestler.
Which is a little bit what? OJ with the banana kind of thing. But also there was a window washer they found later.
So it's like the Iron Claw, except he's
well,
murdering.
I don't know if he... It's unclear if he... There's actually another... There's a window washer who was a suspect who had one of his wife's rings later. They found years later. And that guy was convicted of murdering another person. So there's like another serious suspect.
Oh my God. The listeners are like the randomness of this past 2 minutes of conversation is crazy. It goes from Uncut Gems to The Fugitive to Sam Shepard somehow, but then we find out it's the doctor. Now we're talking about a window washer.
We're
this
all,
is incredible.
You know, this podcast
this.
Can
Sam
always
Shepard
become
the
a true crime podcast if people wanted to. We're ready.
Who really killed JFK?
Oh, here we go. Let me tell you. But we have a vote here. We have a vote here.
Yeah. We didn't really get into why we loved Fugitive all that much.
Well, is it your film?
Really say much, but yeah, should we just vote on it?
Is this yours, Cameron? Because
it's my film. It's
my your film. You gave it a pretty.
No, I mean three of the four winners are mine. The Fugitive's a great film, and it captures so much of that period of crime drama, legal drama, all in one package. Part of the like the appeal is that it really leans in on its two star actors and lets them just kind of give everything that they've got. and Tommy Lee and Harrison Ford are just at their prime. And I think the movie really sits on their shoulders. It's fantastic. Again, the dialogue's amazing.
Matt, if you don't have anything to say further on the subject, I will put it to a vote.
I made up my decision a long time ago.
Okay, let's find out what the results are. I will go first. I'm voting The Fugitive.
Well, I'd like to report to Judge Ito that I find The Fugitive not worthy, and I choose Uncut Gems.
Yeah, Uncut Gems is the better film.
But is it the more perfect film?
Okay, throwing that out there. Is it?
It's the better perfect film.
Hey, let's be clear. So I have one. I've got one in these four. R.I.P.
Well, so the two films, Dark Knight and Unforgiven.
Yeah.
Let me give you an anecdote. So my college dorm mate, who, was always finding interesting things. This is before I was a Nolan fan. I don't even think I was tracking that Nolan was a director. Like I hadn't seen Memento yet. He asked me to come and watch. I think I'd seen Memento, but I don't think I'd connected that Nolan was the same director. So it wasn't tracking Nolan as a director.
What?
So he asked me to come watch this vignette of an upcoming film. He's like, you got to come watch this. This is called The Dark Knight. I want you to watch. Actually, he didn't even say it was Dark Knight. Come watch this thing. So he had this big screen TV, and from his computer, he's streaming this scene, and it's the bank robber scene. And this was released before the movie. So you could see not the whole thing, but like a beginning of this scene with the thumping background sound. And he had an amazing sound system. And I'm watching and I'm thinking, I don't think I've ever seen a scene constructed quite so perfectly. Like, it is just magnificent to watch. Everything about it was like pulse inducing. And I already knew at that point that this movie was going to be an experience film, right? It was like, mm-hmm. I knew going into it that if they were going to show me something that was not a trailer, a traditional trailer, they were just going to give me a scene from the film to let me watch in advance of the film coming out. I was like, there's something about this that's different. This is not your traditional film. And they're clearly willing to take some liberties in terms of what they offer. And it blew me away. I saw it on, I feel like it was IMAX, but maybe it was just like one of those great screens with like stadium seating and felt like IMAX. But I saw it in a nice cinema setting. And, you know, unforgettable. One of those movies that you're like, wow, this is a movie I will never forget. It was extremely powerful. Holy cow, the acting was next level. You know, everybody's thinking Heath Ledger. And I went on to read about, like, you know, the whole conversation between Ledger and Nicholson. And Nicholson's like, don't take on this role. It's going to destroy you. And then, of course, Ledger dies. And then you start to forget what's legend and what's not. But the movie has so much wrapped into it. It's fantastic. And Christian Bale's a great actor, but I'm satisfied that he was not the best actor in that film.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very reminiscent of The Fugitive in that the main character is definitely overshadowed, or like the movie is stolen from the main character by the supporting guy, Tommy Lee Jones, and in this case, Heath Ledger. It's definitely one of those movies for me as well, where I'm like, I'm going to remember seeing that in the theater. I'm going to remember like which theater I was at. Matter of fact, it was I think the first movie I had ever seen in a movie theater more than once. I saw it four times in the movie theater.
I'm still getting over this idea that, Aaron, in 2008, you didn't know who Christopher Nolan was. I want to hear, I feel like you were in the bottom of a cave somewhere and had to climb out with people chanting "Rise." I know that's the later movie, but yeah, Nolan was always, I'm from Memento. When I first saw Memento after showing up 15 minutes late to the movie and it making no sense to me, I was really hooked on Nolan. Memento, Insomnia, Batman Begins. I wasn't as big as on The Prestige, but I loved Batman Begins so much when Dark Knight came out. And I saw that, well, I heard that there was that bank robber scene that was awesome. I didn't want to see it because, unlike with Dune 2, I wanted to go into the movie without seeing an extended sequence. I think the soundtrack was really important. You mentioned this movie pulsing. Uncut Gems is the same. I actually don't know who did the scoring and for Uncut Gems, but Hans Zimmer's scoring of so many Nolan films before he passed the torch really does it for me. It's funny. I think just yesterday there are a bunch of articles how Zimmer's not doing Gladiator 2. And he just like some interviews with him and he's like, look, I did like two Lion King movies he had a bad experience on the Lion King, the live action adaptation. I think it's hard to kind of remake a musical, but he's like, I've done four Kung Fu Pandas, three Batman movies, four Pirates of the Caribbean movies. He's like, I'm kind of done with the blockbuster thing. Gladiator 1. He's like, I really enjoy doing that. And he doesn't want to mess with a good thing. But for me, that pulsing beat of the whole movie from start to finish. No, he'll do that. I mean, well, yeah, and that's the other thing. I loved what he did with Dune 2 soundtrack. I mean, we can't get into that now, but... But yeah, I think Zimmer, like a few of the masters, is able to really hook people.
Yeah, I've also heard that he's trying to kind of like chill out a bit and do less movies. But
well, spicy take. I think Dark Knight is the last best comic book film that's been made. I mean,
you just don't like anything that's come after that.
No, I like them, but they're not great. And it's been diminishing returns from The Dark Knight forward. So I both applaud Christopher Nolan for making a phenomenal comic book film. I think Batman Begins was great. And Dark Knight Rises was fine, but The Dark Knight is this special, incredible film that I think allowed for this massive runway for comic book films. And it has basically been on a gradual downhill slope ever since. And I mean, again, when you're starting at this, like, Leonardo da Vinci level, you can go downhill gradually for a very long time and have a lot of fantastic films out there that are not perfection. But man, did it last for a very long time. And I am so glad that we are beyond it. I think The Dark Knight is also, it is only using the landscape of comic book films to tell a really powerful sort of societal story. And, you know, a lot of the other comic book films that followed it are not doing that. They're telling comic book stories, and the comic book stories are really good, but they're comic book stories. And maybe the only other film that quite hit me like that was in the comic book space was Logan. But apart from those two films, the rest of them are comic book movies. And again, varying degrees of good, but I'm glad this near 20-year span is over.
I mean, I think it's an exaggeration, or I find it an exaggeration to say it was all downhill from Dark Knight. I mean, I think The Dark Knight is the apogee. I mean, it is a perfect film. I think it's one of my choices here. I would watch it again and again. I saw it in the movie theater twice. That and Dumb and Dumber might be the only two that I can remember doing that with. And Dark Knight is the better film. You know, 2008, it comes out after Iron Man. But then I do think those early post-Iron Man Marvel films are not great. They're not great. I think there's a real ramping up that happens between 2014 and at a peak in like 2017-18. That's a five-year period. I think there's ups and downs. It doesn't reach Dark Knight level.
No. I think what I'm saying is, you know, if you draw a trend line, the trend line is not going up from The Dark Knight. I'm not saying that there's no variation. I'm just saying I found nothing after it to be like all those Marvel films except for Logan are just, to me, comic book films. And again, varying degrees of quality. But like Logan was an interesting film. Like it actually is tackling something quasi deeper. And The Dark Knight was doing the same thing. But the rest of the films, I cannot think of one that does that. Not one.
I think Black Panther, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think there's
What's the deeper significance of Black Panther?
The deeper significance
on the spot,
of Black Panther?
Hit me. Yeah.
Do you want to hear?
That's a hot take just asking the question.
No. But I see why he's asking. Tell me. But I mean, I don't know necessarily why he's asking, but I think
I'm waiting.
In Michael B. Jordan's villain,
I think it's like, so obvious like that there's some societal stuff going on in Black Panther that don't even need to be said.
But that's what I'm saying. Look, that's just. But to me, that's just playing off of
No.
That's just playing off of social dysfunction, not a deeper story truly embedded in the film. Like there are a lot of films that can capture some sort of, you know, okay, the zeitgeist right now is XYZ, but it's not really doing anything that's significant. I didn't find Black Panther to do that much of that. I just think it happened to hit at the right moment, had some great performances, and was very like emotionally impressive. But not truly a significantly deeper film. Like I didn't see anything deeper there.
I think the Killmonger character, and I have been waiting for a villain where I'm like, you know, on a general, basically a villain who speaks rationally, who, I think you can kind of like, you don't root for him because I think they made it a little too, they made him just a little too brutal to make it truly, truly gray area and absolutely deep and interesting. But it plays in that space, like with Thanos, where the villain is interesting. And I think those two movies, Infinity War and Black Panther, do get in that space. They're not Dark Knight level, but I think they go way beyond what preceding like 7 to 9 years of Marvel films do. So I think it's not near the peak of The Dark Knight, but I think it's way closer.
Infinity War is the like, should we kill humanity because they're doing bad shit to the world?
Black Panther is
a complex villain.
No, he's absolutely.
I want to boil it down. Just I'm waiting.
No,
what's the Black Panther impact?
we gotta move on. But I completely disagree with what you're saying, Aaron. Except for the fact that The Dark Knight is a perfect movie and is arguably the best comic book movie. And I think that it's a pretty rare thing for something to sort of kickstart a trend that would dominate for so long, but also for the thing that kickstarted it to forever be the best at that thing.
The Godfather.
I mean, yeah, I was going to say that. The Godfather is kind of like that.
Aaron, I think what you said is similar to saying that The Godfather, like everything was in a gradual downhill in the mafia genre since The Godfather. I don't think it's a gradual downhill. I think people can strongly make the case that Goodfellas is the best mafia film. I have a hard time being persuaded about any other.
I don't think anything else can make a case for being better than The Dark Knight. I don't think it's a gradual downhill post-Godfather.
For mafia?
Like, whereas, you know, you've got this. Yeah. I mean, I think there's lots of movies that grace those echelons. I just think The Godfather is seminal and people love it. And there's like an emotional connection to it. And I think it's fantastic. But even Godfather Part Two may be better than Godfather. So like, I don't know that there is this like definitive quality to that. The way with Dark Knight, it's definitive. Like there is no other comic book film out there that even holds a candle to it. And again, like Logan, which isn't even hold a candle to it, is just like, it just like is a film that resonated and has this kind of deeper societal quality to it, or like exploration of this person's like aging. So yeah, I see nothing that's even close.
Well, if you're bringing up The Godfather Part Two, I'll just throw in a hot take that I sometimes fight with myself over whether I think Batman Begins is a better movie than The Dark Knight.
You have to explain yourself. That I can't support that, but I want to hear what you have to say.
I think that there's... I said it was a hot take. I'm not trying to act like this is not a hot take. But I do think that The Batman Begins is incredible, and I think it matches The Dark Knight. And I think a lot of people actually hold this view. The only reason I'm bringing this up is to just contest the idea that The Dark Knight is far and away the greatest comic book movie ever made. I think it's the best, but I don't think it's like for example, I'll give a movie that came post The Dark Knight that is a perfect movie and is also a comic book movie. Spider-Verse, whichever the first one is called. I get the weird name, not across, Into the Spider-Verse. I think is a perfect movie, but it's not, it just doesn't have the same impact for a number of reasons. And I don't think that that should be held against it. Just like I think The Dark Knight should be put into context.
Actually, I'm gonna vibe with you there for a second, because I think Into the Spider-Verse is probably exceeds Logan for me in terms of being a better comic book film than anything else Marvel put out.
Yeah,
it's fantastic, and it is deep, and then it does get into societal stuff. it touches a lot. Whereas I think Black Panther was hollow for me. Into the Spider-Verse was not. That is, I mean, again, I recognize the Black Panther take is a hot take. Also a film where, is it the same if Chadwick Boseman doesn't croak? I don't know. Like,
he died a long time after that.
No, but it's not that long afterwards.
What are you smoking, man?
It was not a long time, like half a decade.
That is not.
He's not even in the sequel. He's not even in the sequel, right?
Yeah, you haven't seen the sequel. He's in the sequel. His spirit lives on.
I think it's totally relevant to the glory of the film.
No,
he's
no,
not
no.
even in the sequel.
You've got your chronology all messed up. You had too many children.
Sorry, let me understand. Let me understand, Matt. Is he in Black Panther 2?
Yeah.
That doesn't matter.
Did I miss something?
Black Panther.
It does matter. He was intended to be in the movie, right?
He's in it. He's in it. He's a tribute.
Okay. All right. Anyway, I think Black Panther.
I didn't say Black Panther 2 was a deep movie. I said Black Panther 1.
I don't think Black Panther is. I think it's a very entertaining film. I think it's really, fun to watch. It's like almost a Lion King quality to it, but it is not. It is not anything special. I think it's just a fantastic that there is the celebration of a black superhero and a black villain and an awesome movie that really captures all that you want out of a superhero film. It's great. It's awesome. Is it super deep? No. Is it super impactful in terms of like what it's saying message-wise? No. Into the Spider-Verse was. That touched in a different way, and it was interesting in a different way. Yes, it's a kid's movie, but it was deeper. And I vibe with that. That take makes sense to me, but I will stand to the Black Panther was not, it's the Barbie of its year, which is a great film, but not a perfect film at all.
Wow.
Nobody was saying it was perfect, man.
I love these. Wait. I love these piping hot takes, but we got to move on to the other movie.
Wait. Let me tell. I need to tell you two things about Circumstances.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
One, Into the Spider-Verse. You guys have heard this story, but the people must know. What enhanced this movie for me was in the middle of the movie in my house. I went to get a drink of water, and a spider the size of 3/4 had dropped over the sink right when I got the water, and I almost became Spider-Man. That brought the multiverse to a new level. No, it would have if I hadn't, but I didn't want to go that route. Secondly,
you didn't want to go the route of being Spider-Man?
I've watched the Sam Raimi movies, man. It's that way it brings pain. No, the other is circumstances. Like, I mean, the Chadwick Boseman dying affecting the status of Black Panther's ridiculous. That only elevated to 5 bloods. But moving on from that, Kurt Cobain. So I do think that his death elevated Nirvana, and Heath Ledger's has elevated The Dark Knight. However, I mean, having grown up at the time and being a Nirvana fan as a kid and being around a lot of Nirvana fans, he was in a massively high status even before his suicide. Like, if Eddie Vedder had died, I think Pearl Jam would have skyrocketed further up. But if, like, the lead singer, one of the lead singers of Sonic Youth had died, like, it would have not been a big deal. So it's just like, I think it depends. If it really, a death or a circumstance can really elevate something, if it already has that cachet or status, like, and I think The Dark Knight would have had it on its own, but Heath Ledger's, you know, tragic death before the film, you know, certainly elevated it. But for me, that doesn't affect the viewing of the film. I think we need to move to the comic films of the past, which are Westerns.
Ooh, that is a fantastic segue. Unforgiven. I would actually say that this is a great segue because The Dark Knight is maybe the seminal work of comic books. And it came at the, not the beginning of the comic book genre, but came at the beginning of a huge, 21st century wave of comic book movies. Whereas Unforgiven was sort of the cap of Westerns and was basically the end. Like, I think we can, I think we can pretty unanimously agree that there has not been a movie since Unforgiven in the Western genre that has come close to Unforgiven. Maybe that's something we can agree on.
In the traditional Western genre, that is not some like hell or high water modern Western thing. Yeah. Unforgiven is the last great Western, and it is, as I've discussed with you guys ad nauseum, a complete deconstruction of the genre in a way that has never and will never be surpassed, in my view. I don't think there's any hope in that genre of furthering what can be done in the Western. I think there is a possibility of that happening with comic book films. I think there will be a period in which comic books, you know, comic book films will rest. There will be an opportunity for fans to age, and there'll be a revisiting, a nostalgic revisiting of that genre. And some filmmaker years from now will do something amazing to deconstruct the genre in an Unforgiven like way. But Unforgiven does, it has all the like resonant components of a Western. You know, every single, even of course its lead, who is the like quintessential silent, strong, you know, six shooter Western figure, stars, and yet he encapsulates this deconstruction absolutely perfectly. He is a flawed character, which often the Western lead was not, a truly flawed character, not a quasi flawed, like he drinks a little too much or he might womanize a little bit, but like a deeply flawed and internally reflective character. The villain may not be as villainous as one thinks, but is also like extremely hard, like the Gene Hackman character. There's really only one victim in the film, one true victim, and it's like this Morgan Freeman character who is, you know, sacrificed like Jesus in many ways. And there's just all this like really phenomenal character building, depth of exploration of this genre, and unpacking all these tropes and kind of pulling back the layers. Like the idea of this like magnificent gunfighter is completely unraveled and discussed in a very clear way. You know, like it's not the person who has this amazing shot. It's the person who can be the calmest in a chaotic environment when everyone else is shooting off in the distance. And you see that, and that foreshadowing comes to full fruition in that famous bar scene when, of course, you know, Clint Eastwood takes a drink after not having taken a drink for a very long time. It just, it's utterly brilliant. I get like, you know, goosebumps just talking about it. And I saw that film at a particularly formative age. And I remember my uncle, who is like, the Western was his comic book, watched all of them. And he was like, there are two Westerns you have to see in your life. Two: The Outlaw Josie Wales and Unforgiven. Both are amazing, but man, Unforgiven is extra special for all the reasons I just described and so many more.
Yeah, I mean, I just have to second all that. I mean, this film in its simplicity and perfection does all those things. Deconstructs while it maintains the strictures of the genre, but it doesn't feel like, it's not like an exercise or a takedown. I think the characters all have a life of their own, and the story is just one I've thought about. I watched this the same year I watched The Dark Knight. I saw it very late, so that's about, you know what, 26 years ago now. That's not true. 16 years ago, I did not get a 10-year advance viewing of The Dark Knight. I can't believe it's been 16 years since The Dark Knight's come out. That is crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, this film, it does all of that. The Gene Hackman character, in the way, is like, he's kind of the other side of the Joker coin, because he's sort of about order, but he's really, I mean, he also just an authoritarian and trying to, you know, make a place in, under his own thumb and image. But he's very, you know, the Joker's kind of taking everything apart, and Gene Hackman is like literally building a house.
The house building and the leaky house that he's building is maybe on, you know, sort of describing it, it feels like it's on the nose, but it's not in the film. It's brilliantly done. You know, I think it's set in Wyoming, and there's this big storm, and the movie never has a film for me developed so much and built so much tension that culminates in one final extremely cinematic end as Unforgiven. It just does it. You're kind of on this slow ride where it's building, and you meet these like fascinating characters along the way, but you know, it's coming to some kind of extremely tragic end. And you're not sure how it's going to get there, but when it gets there, you know, everything's going to have to be resolved in this one catastrophic moment. And it's just done so effectively. And there's a character, a young character in it, who's this like aspiring gunslinger. There's something about the fact that he chooses to no longer pursue the gunslinging profession, and he does so out of this kind of almost reverence for Clint Eastwood's, even though he's a flawed character, it's like there's something very real about it. You know, it you feel that, oh man, this is what happened back then, not these kind of, you know, oh, I want to be just like you, and I am going to be. It's majestic. There's a very old Western called Shane, which is, you know, it's a little Andy Griffith in some of its like dialogue and so forth. But the film is similar in being this kind of, you feel that this could have occurred in a Western scenario, and all through Unforgiven, you feel that. all through it. Like the people look like you assume they would have looked at that time. It's stylistic only in that it captures what must have been real for those people. And that is really, I've waited for something like that. And of course, maybe it's not even worth doing at this point, but for like the stories of Billy the Kid or some of these other, you know, famous gunslingers where they don't give that kind of heroic take, but maybe a little bit of a darker take about what are these characters and what do they mean.
I think you're right. Few movies, especially in the Western genre, have truly, and this might be the only one that like truly attempts to demythologize the legend of the Wild West.
That is a perfect word, demythologize. That captures it perfectly.
With the movie, well, so I thought the bookends of this movie, the beginning and the end, I usually don't like narration or any sort of writing, title cards on screen. But I just thought how this movie was framed with how Clint Eastwood's late wife thought of him worked really well. And I, maybe some people would have thought that's too constructed or too on the nose, but I thought it weird at the start, but then at the end of the movie, it set me thinking. And because of the way I like how this movie is constructed, I was like, who wrote this? I don't know. Do you guys know much about the screenwriter?
Yes. David Peoples, I think. David Webb Peoples.
Yeah, David
I think
Peoples.
He did Blade Runner, didn't he? And 12 Monkeys.
He did. He did Blade Runner and 12 Monkeys, which is quite a trifecta.
Yeah. I mean, he's pretty impressive.
He's obviously spectacular.
His first film that he wrote was a documentary. Mm. It was called The Day After Trinity. Can you guess who the subject was of that documentary?
Oppenheimer.
Yes. So it's a documentary, 1980, about Oppenheimer. And that quote comes from when Oppenheimer was asked in the interview at the end of this movie what he thought of Robert F. Kennedy's efforts to try to get LBJ to reduce nuclear weapons. And Oppenheimer says, it's 20 years too late. It should have been done the day after Trinity.
Wow. Fascinating. Oh. Fascinating. We're back to Kennedy.
Yeah.
And to Nolan.
Yeah. And he rides on that for a decade. I mean, Million Dollar Baby, Gran Torino, like all of those movies are basically...
That's 2 decades, man.
Well, I mean, yeah. However long it is. And there's a period from Unforgiven to, I think Gran Torino is the last one that kind of caps off that period. But it's like a lot of movies where he's like an old, irascible, but kind of flawed character, lead character in it. They're all brilliant, but I none of them really for me eclipse Unforgiven in terms of that exploration.
Okay, let's put this to a vote.
We still have a finals. We have a finals to go.
Well, I know. Let's put it to a vote. We're running late on time. Two movies which we definitely did not plan to match up in this way, but it's fascinating how we've sort of, through conversation, seeing that they're like mirrors of each other in some ways. I guess I'll continue the trend and vote first. I'll take The Dark Knight.
So I changed my mind through the course of this conversation.
Ooh.
I was hard into The Dark Knight and I switched to Unforgiven.
I will be Unforgiven.
So I've lost.
We're ganging up on you,
I know,
Cameron.
I've lost twice now.
The old guys.
It honestly is like a coin flip for me.
Me too, yeah.
They're just both incredible movies. Okay, we have our final matchup is Unforgiven versus Uncut Gems. Two uns.
Unbelievable.
Okay, what do we need to say to discern which one's better than the other?
I think this is not as hard for me as the one we just did, but
I was going to say the same thing. I kind of wish that matchup was our final.
Yeah.
I'm really struggling with how to match them up. Yeah. They're very different films for me and very different experiences. One is extremely like slow as molasses philosophical exploration that is wonderfully satisfying. Like you want to take another bite and another bite. And the other is a thrill ride.
It's a line of
that cocaine. Is also philosophical, but yeah, it's a line of cocaine, and you do reflect on that experience and think about it in a way that's extremely philosophical. And both films know that they're saying something significant. So they're not sort of positioning themselves as like, this is not Die Hard and we're saying it's a perfect film. They're both saying something really significant. And the Safdie brothers, I think they tell you that by that last visual of, you know, going into the opal, which is the universe, which is, you know, this chaotic, you know, uncontrolled space. So, you know, I think that was a perfect ending to Uncut Gems. I actually think the ending to Uncut Gems, though, was, I should say, the denouement, the post ending, the post extremely cinematic part of both of those films, that part of Uncut Gems wins over Unforgiven for me, because I think Unforgiven's very final scene, which is harkens back to a lot of Clint Eastwood films where there's like a, and the ride's off into the sunset. And this is like, you know, a much sort of quieter, simpler riding off into the sunset. And you don't really know what happens. The rumor says, legend has. But I felt like it was kind of unnecessary. Like, I really kind of wish the movie had just ended without that. Whereas with Uncut Gems, I loved that it ended the way it ended. And I love that it went into the opal like that.
I love both endings. I think that sort of ride off into the sunset and postscript epilogue is common in that genre. I like this because I'd forgotten about the wife, basically the whole movie. And then it's just like, it's such an ugly action ending before that. But then it's like, this is why someone loved this man. And you're like, oh. It helped me understand a lot that I didn't understand about things when I was, I don't know, what was I, like 25? I don't know.
Interesting, I guess, to like sort of draw a comparison, a mirror, is that they both have bookends on the movies. Correct me if I'm wrong, but they both start and end with the same image. Is that right?
We're similar, yeah.
I'm struggling with this one, but I would say Uncut Gems is an utterly surprising film and something that, it feels like an album that is like a concept album and like every track works. And Unforgiven feels like an ensemble album and all the singers are great, but and the songs are like mostly great, but it's like you already expect it to be great because you know all these are great singers, and you're like, I know this is going to be amazing. Look at this film. It's a Western. It's got all the right actors in it. It's got all the right parts. It's going to be great. And then you go in, you're like, it is great, but holy shit. Like, it is great for reasons I never expected, because it does all this demythologizing. It does all this deconstructing. And you're like, oh my God, like all these people revisited a genre that needed to be revisited. And we never need to see it again. The door is closed. Whereas Uncut Gems felt like this kind of extremely novel, never seen before kind of film. And I don't know which one wins, because they're both powerful, but they're very different experiences. I even with like positive reviews going into Uncut Gems, I'm like, wait a minute, like who are these other actors? And Adam Sandler's the lead, and like, what is this? Like, nothing to hang my hat on at all. And you got lots to hang your hat on in Unforgiven. It's like all these greats coming back for one last hurrah. So I don't know. I that doesn't necessarily help make the decision easier, but it does distinguish the types of movies.
No, I like that analogy. Yeah, I'm also struggling to find like a legitimate critique of or a bolstering of one movie over the other. I think this unless you have something on this, this may just need to come down to a vote.
But I'm a little troubled now. I hate to be so impressionable. It's when I am at a fast pace, like when we were talking about Uncut Gems, we were talking about The Dark Knight, those movies seemed really perfect to me. But then we mellowed in the whiskey barrel for a while, and then Unforgiven seems perfect. I'm like, slow-paced, and there's all this stuff happening over with Uncut Gems. I'm like, yeah, that was really mind-blowing and novel, but it's just not, it's not perfection. It's, but then when I'm at that pace of Uncut Gems, Unforgiven seems like it's too much of grass growing. So I'm like really puzzled right now.
I feel like I have to be the one to vote first, because I feel like you guys have voted first throughout this this Thunderdome, and I feel like I owe that to you, kind of like, you know, the winner needs to go first kind of thing. So I'm going to throw my vote in the ring for Uncut Gems.
I think we should have done a simultaneous.
Too late now.
Well, I got vote for Cry Macho. So there is a flaw for me. Well, anyway, movies, there's a big flaw for me that always didn't sit right with me.
You got to tell us flaw.
But it's, I mean, you already have one vote on the table.
Well, that doesn't hurt. But you can tell us your flaw. I've put myself out there.
That might change my mind.
But it wouldn't. I mean, maybe you should vote first.
Okay, how about this? I will vote, and then I will give you an honest answer as to whether maybe what you're about to tell me might have changed my vote.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. We're doing a weird thing here, but I like it.
My gut is to vote for Unforgiven. And I'm mainly going off the fact that I feel like it impacted me a little bit more deeply than Uncut Gems did.
Okay, then we did this the right way. So I had a hard time. When I'm thinking fast, when I'm in that mode, Uncut Gems seems right. When I'm in a slow, contemplative mode, Unforgiven seems right. But the sort of what kicks off the final act in Unforgiven has always bugged me a little bit. I've always felt that this essential moment. I mean, this essential plot device where Morgan Freeman's tortured and killed. Like it never felt natural to me. And it always felt rushed. And I know this is like a nitpick, but like watching the movie, I was like, yeah, this has to happen for Clint Eastwood to break and to have this final climax. But it always felt to me like it was like, we need this. We need someone to die. We need there to be a lamb who's like sacrificed for Clint Eastwood to break. And I never found it like, it doesn't have to, you know, there's so much deconstruction and realism in that movie, and that felt like, well, and then like Gene Hackman he grabbed him and then he like brutally killed him and put him in a coffin like he's a prop in a haunted house. And I know that's like a really weird nitpick, but that part of the movie never set right with me, so I'm going with Uncut Gems. I know it's like a really weird technicality, but when you said like is there something you'd change? Like I always wanted something about that part to be more natural, more different, more aligned with the rest of the movie. And I can't think of a part of Uncut Gems that's like that. So I was going to vote for Uncut Gems if I voted second as well. Or if I was leaning towards it going first, but I couldn't articulate why. So have we had this before with like a Villanova national championship in the 80s with the lowest seed taking the title?
Oh, yeah. I don't think we have. That'd be interesting. We should go back and look at that.
Oh, take that. Take that, Rotten Tomatoes and IMDb. I think the composite's still pretty high, but
well, that was a really fun episode. It went much longer than I think any of us expected, as most of our episodes do, but
edit liberally.
Okay, guys, there you have it. We have deemed the best of the perfect movies is Uncut Gems.
I feel like this is going to generate some chatter among the four people who listen.
That was fun. Look forward to the next go-around. Thanks for listening.
That's all, folks.